Hi, do you have sleeping children?
Rosalie's awake right now. She just woke up at like 2:30. So I always leave that out there though, because there's like one UPS person.
1 or 2 o'clock.
Is it okay for me to park in your driveway?
Okay, it's fine. That's totally fine.
Should I take my shoes off?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm Jessica Marquardt, and this is Kaleidoscope, the podcast where we have conversations about a growing public health crisis, cortical visual impairment. CVI is the leading cause of pediatric visual impairments in the developed world. 30 to 40% of kids with a visual impairment have CVI. No matter where you're listening to this, it's likely there is another CVI family nearby. You just may not know how to find them. We don't have a CVI census. Who knows where all these kids are? We don't have local chapters of any given CVI advocacy organization. And while we have virtual touch points, like Facebook groups and telesupport calls, we have very few opportunities to make real, live contact with fellow CVI families. So when you make a CVI mom friend who lives 2 minutes outside your office's back door, you cling tight. Stephanie Kung, mother of 18-month-old Rosalie, and the writer behind the blog Everyday CVI, is practically my neighbor. Our children have had access to the same healthcare systems and early intervention programs, yet our experiences have been different in many ways. My daughter Grace is 7, about 6 years older than Rosalie. As many parents with older children with CVI can attest, knowledge of CVI has grown and spread over time, although not fast enough for any of us. I sincerely hope that it will become the norm for parents of babies with CVI to be given appropriate diagnoses and resources from day one. Rosalie's story demonstrates that this may be happening incrementally. Yet there's one variable, a driving force, really, that makes her trajectory unique, and that's her mom, Stephanie.
Okay. It's been 6 months since I've been here to visit. We had coffee last summer.
That's right.
And then a few months ago, got together for the North Carolina CVI parent thing that we're trying to get rally together. Folks yeah. to participate yeah. in. But I'm glad to get to see you, even though you're right around the corner from where I work. Do you drive past there?
I do.
At all?
A decent amount, yeah.
So there's a brand new building at the back, and that's where I just moved.
Oh, okay.
I have a view of the solar panels back there and the little sheep.
I love driving by the farm that's around there. I always tell the boys, like, look out the window, and we see different animals sometimes.
Yeah, for city people, it's really exciting.
Yeah, it's a nice little oasis. So.
Thanks for taking time to talk to me today. I read somewhere, I can't remember if it was on your blog or on Facebook, that you call Rosalie small and mighty. So how else would you describe her?
Rosalie is, I would say, so joyful. She's just like the happiest baby. And that's really saying a lot because all of my kids have been happy babies, but I think she just kind of like takes it to a whole nother level. She just is always so happy. She's determined. Like, she's a fighter. You know, I see her like work hard at things and then she's so proud of herself for accomplishing that. I just think that's huge. Even for any kid, you want them to have that skill throughout their life. But then when you have kids with an added, you know, a disability or special needs, you know, that's just going to benefit them so much throughout life.
Yeah, that grit factor.
Yes, exactly. So it's just really exciting to see that she has that. So
she's already been through a lot. Yes. So she has hydrocephalus, which there's no cure for that. But can you tell us more about that diagnosis and what it means for Rosalie?
Sure. So hydrocephalus is, like you said, it's a brain condition that has no cure. So currently the only treatment for that really is brain surgery. But it's a condition where there's an excess buildup of cerebrospinal fluid in the brain. So, you know, our brains make cerebrospinal fluid, or CSF, and it's a super important fluid that really, like, it cushions our brain, it protects it, but then it also drains through the ventricle system of the brain down into the spine, and it goes out into the body and has all these really important functions. But so in hydrocephalus, essentially the brain is producing the CSF at a normal rate, but then somewhere along the way, for whatever reason, there may be like an obstruction or just the anatomy didn't form totally normally to the point where the CSF does not drain out through the ventricles at the same rate that it's being produced. So you get like this buildup of fluid in the brain. And then that, of course, puts pressure on the brain as well. So like I said, the only treatment is brain surgery, which, you know, is typically always placing a shunt, which is a piece of hardware that puts a catheter in the brain, and it basically creates like another like a bypass, another way for the fluid to get out of the brain so that it doesn't build up and build up the pressure inside of there. So there's basically a valve that it feeds through, and then it empties through a catheter that goes underneath the skin. And, you know, it just follows a path. The most common patient empties into the stomach, and then the fluid is just reabsorbed by the body. So that's the way that it's treated, by placing a shunt, and that manages the levels of fluid and the pressure in the brain.
And so she's had four brain surgeries, yes, including one when she was just 2 days old.
Right. Yeah.
And that was to place, was that to place the shunt?
Yes. So her first brain surgery, we knew about her hydrocephalus diagnosis when I was pregnant with her, because she already had a severe case by the time we had our anatomy scan. I was about 18 weeks pregnant. We knew going into this that she was going to need surgery. She was full term, but she was 37 weeks, like on the dot, like that day. They wanted to get her, you know, a shunt as soon as possible, just with where her fluid levels were at. Mm-hmm. So she was 2 days old. They placed a shunt. And, you know, if everything goes well with the shunt and there's no complications, then that's great, and you don't need to do more surgeries. But the unfortunate reality is just that shunts are notorious for complications. Mm-hmm. So infection is really common because it is a brain surgery. So, you know, the blood-brain barrier, it doesn't allow antibodies that fight off bacteria into your brain. So if even like a tiny speck of something gets in, that can develop into an infection. And then the other common complication is just a malfunction where something gets clogged, maybe the catheter, or cells can stick to things or scar tissue, and it just can block the flow of the fluid in some way. Sometimes it might break or something's just clogged. They might have to go in and revise the shunt or completely place a new one. So her first one at 2 days old was just to place her first shunt. And then she's had subsequent surgeries because when she was 6 weeks old, she developed a shunt infection. So that's like emergency surgery to get it out, and then do a full course of antibiotics to kill off the infection. And so they do like a temporary external drain when she can't have the shunt to control the fluid, because you can't put another shunt in until you kill off the infection. So then her third surgery was placing a new shunt after the infection. And then that one was good for a little while, but then ultimately that one malfunctioned. Hmm. And so then she had to have another emergency surgery to replace that one. So this is her third shunt that she's had.
Have you met any other parents who have kids with hydrocephalus and CVI?
Online, yeah. I have, yes. So there's one mom that I did meet somewhat locally that her daughter does have hydrocephalus, but her daughter doesn't have CVI. She does have some other vision stuff going on, because that's pretty common with hydrocephalus. I think it's like 1 in 3 kids born with hydrocephalus will have some type of vision problem, whether it's an ocular or obviously a neurological-based vision impairment. But online, you can really connect with people. So
Thank goodness for Facebook.
Yes, absolutely. So I have found some people that have been in the same boat.
Okay, that's good to find a support system. So these rare diagnoses, it's hard to feel like you're not alone or like you have a support system. You probably didn't know anyone at the point, though, that Rosalie was going through these surgeries. So how did you deal with the stress of such a scary thing?
That's a good question, because it's just hard, you know, no matter what. But I think on a practical level, you know, my husband and I are, we're people that like, we always like as much information as possible. We want to plan for the worst case scenario. Like, he's an engineer. That's like what he does. You plan for the worst case scenario. So I think that when something happens, we try to, in the moment, just kind of like put the emotions to the side and think logically and say, okay, this is the situation we're in right now. What needs to happen like right now? And there's so much you can't control, but then there are some things that you can control or, you know, prepare yourself for, plan for. We just kind of go into that emergency mode of, okay, well, I'm going to take her to the hospital. What are we going to do with her brothers? What do you have going on with work? Do you have meetings? Can you block her schedule? Like, should I call these people, see if they can come over? Just try and figure it out kind of like step by step. And sometimes that's hour by hour. And then once you know what you're dealing with in the hospital, it might be day by day, you know, and we're just kind of like constantly reevaluating, okay, what do we need today? what are we going to do for our other kids mm-hmm. that are at home? What do they need? And then what do we need to be doing for Rosalie? You know, I think that that helps trying to go into that mode of like, what can we work on? What can we fix? And then obviously we've had to rely on people for help. That's been a huge thing. Like, we relied on my mom a lot. She, you know, she recently moved to the area, which is so fantastic.
I love it.
To have family support, that's huge. But she didn't live here when Rosalie was born, but she came to help us out when we knew she was going to be in the hospital and having surgery, and we didn't know how long she'd be in the NICU or anything at that point. She came for weeks to help us, and then actually when she developed the shunt infection, once we knew it was an infection and not just a malfunction that would be a couple days in the hospital, this was going to be weeks, I called my mom up, and she had, like, just gone home maybe a week or two before that. I was like, so, Mom, can you come back?
Come on back, Mom.
Please. And she did. It was so helpful. But even just local people, too, we've learned to allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough to say, like, we have an emergency situation going on. Please pray for us, or something like that, right. Just to let people know something. And then that kind of like allows opportunity for people to reach out to you. People will text me and say, do you need anything? Like, what can I do? Like, can I bring you a meal? Or I had one friend one time, I think it was when she had the shunt infection, we went back in to the hospital, and it was the day that I normally go grocery shopping. And so this friend didn't even know. My husband and I were texting back and forth, like, what are we going to do about the groceries? Like, we have no food at home. And she texted me. She was like, I want to order you groceries. Where do you usually shop? I'm going to send you groceries. And it was just like,
what a nice gift.
Such a gift, you know, allowing ourselves to be open to receiving help, asking for help when we need it, but also really like saying yes when people offer, because that's just not in my husband's and my nature. Like,
it's really hard.
It is hard. Like, we're typically very just self-sufficient people. We don't like to ask for help. But when you have a situation like that, especially a medical emergency, I mean, you just can't survive without other people's help sometimes.
Right.
So
it's very good advice. Yeah. It is hard to be vulnerable in that way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it is easier, I should say, when you can take action. Like you said, you're very action oriented. Right. So when you have a whole list of things that you know you can tackle mm-hmm. and that you're capable of tackling, it's within your abilities at that
right.
point. That
right.
feels good. It helps you feel like you have momentum going forward. But
definitely.
There are those quiet moments when you don't know how long your child's going to be in the hospital mm-hmm. or they're in the surgery and you're probably just praying fervently.
Yeah.
And then, of course, just things that you can't do when you're in the hospital for your other children. And
right.
Yeah.
And that's always really hard, too. Because our other kids are young as well, and they're used to me being home with them. So it's a big challenge for the whole family if I have to be gone for a long time.
Right.
Or even just juggling. I try and come home every day and see them for a little bit. It's still just not their normal routine.
Mm-hmm.
There's always kind of like a balance of juggling everybody's needs. And
balance. It's overrated.
It's tough. But.
So when did you find out that Rosalie had CBI, and how did that unfold?
Yeah, we found out when she was 7 months old. I think I mentioned earlier that kids born with hydrocephalus are really at high risk for having vision problems. And so at one of her follow-up appointments, you know, they were kind of looking at her medical records, and they were like, oh, you know, she has not seen an eye doctor yet. And they were like, normally we would have done that by now for her since she was born with hydrocephalus. It kind of like fell through the cracks with just being in and out of the hospital so much and, you know, pushing back all these appointments. Mm-hmm. So they're like, we're going to go ahead and schedule that for you. She's about 4 months old at that point, but the wait list was like, you know, 3 months to get in. By the time we got into the eye doctor, she was 7 months old. It was actually like a pretty straightforward diagnosis. Thankfully, I realize that's like not the norm
right.
for most people, but we went in and, you know, they examined her eyes and, you know, she clearly had these abnormal visual behaviors. And it was something that my husband and I already, we knew that, but we didn't know about CBI. We didn't even know it existed. I assumed if she was going to have vision problems, they were ocular condition. I was convinced maybe they're going to say she needs glasses or something. We went in and they basically told us her eyes are completely healthy. The eye doctor was describing to me what she saw with her optic nerves and everything looked really good. And she's had so many MRIs because of her hydrocephalus. And this was all through Duke, which is where all her specialists are. So they could easily access her imaging. They pulled it up and they were looking at it. And I remember thinking, oh, that's really cool. They can pull that up and look at it. But I didn't really understand why, like, for a vision, you know, an eye
exam.
Why they would do that. But they pulled it up, they looked at it, And so they tell me her eyes are totally healthy, but what we see is a different type of vision impairment called cortical vision impairment, or CVI. And they explained to me that it's, a brain-based vision impairment. And they gave me good information, honestly.
Really? What did they point you to?
So, well, I would say the one thing that could have been better is really they didn't give me any resources or information at the time to go home with. But in the appointment, I was told, because it's a brain-based vision impairment, the brain is so amazing at making these new connections that she can learn to better understand what she's seeing. Like, she can improve. The eye doctor immediately said, I'm going to put in to her list of diagnoses that she's legally blind. She's like, I don't want you to freak out by that. And she explained what legally blind is. We don't know really how she's functioning with her vision. She's so young, but by putting this on her list of diagnoses, this will give you access to vision services. And she's like, I'm going to make a referral for this state agency to call you and set that up. We were already in early intervention at that point because of her hydrocephalus. We were doing physical therapy. We were about to start occupational therapy. So I was just kind of asking her about that and, you know, well, what kinds of things can you do to help them learn better? And she told me like a few things that were really basic, but they were accurate. So at least I was given good information. You know, she was like, well, you know, you might need to give her more time to look at things, which I already honestly knew about Rosalie. That was one of the things that in hindsight, like, we knew all this stuff about her visual behaviors, but we just didn't know that it was CVI or what that was. But, you know, and she told me she might need to see like really bright colors or like maybe move things back and forth to get her to look at it. And I think that's about the extent of what she told me. Mm-hmm. But at least it was good information. It was accurate information. But I feel like the way she told me, it was kind of almost so casual, like, oh, well, it's a vision impairment that it'll just get better. And we're just going to give you this referral to these services. And so I did not have a good understanding in the moment of what CVI really meant and kind of like the magnitude of how it really impacts every aspect of every day and every little thing we've been doing with her, and the fact that it's a disability that is never going to leave her. I really just didn't understand that or get a sense of that until I went home and immediately started researching and, you know, obsessively learning all that I could.
Right.
So
that's a little bit different of an experience than we had at the same place.
Right. Yeah.
And so it varies from doctor to doctor for sure. We were told to wait and watch. Mm-hmm. Grace also got a diagnosis pretty easily based on her MRI. It was clear that there was brain damage there, but we weren't given resources either. But we do feel fortunate that the diagnosis was written as such that she was considered legally blind as well, so that we could get the...
It gives you the access to services.
So.
Yeah, exactly.
So you went home and you started to research. What did you find? And then what did you start to implement?
Yeah, I think right away I found the Little Bear Sees website. That was really helpful, I think, in just kind of getting my mind thinking about how, wow, there's like lots of little things you can be doing everywhere. I'm sure I found the Start Seeing CVI website. Like, a lot of these parent-led resources are really what I found. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really just so thankful for all of these parents that have created all these resources, because I think like if we were in this place 5 years ago, like what resources would have been out there? You know, there's just not a lot out there. But I also went on Facebook and found CVI groups, and, you know, I did like a search history in the threads of comments for books, websites, resources. So I quickly learned about, you know, Dr. Roman and her book and Perkins School for the Blind and the resources they have. And very first thing that I did to implement was, I think I got this idea from Little Bear Sees, but I just went to the closet where we have all our gift wrap and I pulled out like a red shiny bow that you would put on a package, and I stuck that on Rosalie's spoon so that when I would feed her, I would show her the spoon and get her attention because she would look at the bow, and I would make sure she was really looking at it before, you know, I would feed her. And before I knew about her CVI, we'd started doing some puree foods when she was maybe around 6 months or so. And before, she would never open her mouth for the spoon. I would have to like bring it to her lip and I would kind of touch her bottom lip, and then she'd open her mouth to be fed. And once I put the bow on and started doing this, she started opening her mouth
Amazing.
Like, oh, there's something coming at my face, right. You know? She just couldn't see it before.
That's something I wish I had clued into when Grace was that young. Yeah. I think maybe we could have avoided feeding therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've been on the brink of, like, almost needing feeding therapy a few times just because also with her hydrocephalus and not being able to sit up at the same age other kids do because they're born with a larger, heavier head, you know, they're slower to be able to even sit up in the high chair and they need a lot of support and stuff like that. So, I mean, there have been times where her weight gain wasn't so great just because we were really limited by her positioning and then obviously her CVI, like not being able to see and feed herself off of a tray. You know, we've got to like spoon feed her a lot of purees and, you know, get her enough calories, but she's been making a lot of progress. So I think we're probably not going to have to do some like feeding therapy, but
yeah, because who needs another therapy?
Exactly. I'm trying so hard. I'm like, I really don't want to add another one. So if we can just give her enough time to work through this stuff and take it at her own pace, then we'll do that. So
you also have her special area in your living room set up for her activities. Can you describe that so people can know? Because you did that quite early.
Yeah, we did do that early. And it's evolved too as she's gotten a little bigger and a little more mobile. She's not totally mobile yet, but so we have a space in our living room and then upstairs in our playroom. At this point now, we have like a black mat. It's kind of like those foam mats that you puzzle piece together that you would use for like an in-home gym or something. I think that's usually what people use with like the black mats, but I just went on Amazon and found some sets of those. And so that creates like a little space where she can roll around and do tummy time and, you know, look for toys. And I went out and got one of those science fair trifold boards to put behind it so that we can block out distractions, or when I'm working on her sitting up and looking at things, can have that background behind just to let her see that contrast of the colors. And we try and keep minimal toys out on the mat at a time. Other kids her age would just be fine to like dump all the toys and find them, but obviously that's just too much for a kid with CVI. So we'll just put out a few of her favorite things at a time and then switch it out. And yeah, it's just created a nice little space where she can really roll around and see what is there.
Mm-hmm. If you don't mind, I'll take a picture of it before I leave and include it in the show notes so that people can visualize it in case they're looking for their own home baby CVI gym.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So you've also had the opportunity to work with Perkins Roman CVI range endorsed provider, which is like getting a diagnosis, another challenging thing to attain for a lot of people because they're just very few people out there who have been able to go forward and get that credentialing. And for people who don't exactly know what it is, it's a credentialing process through Perkins School for the Blind, where people can demonstrate that they're able to conduct the CVI range, which was created by Dr. Christine Roman. And of course, we want people to show that they know how to use the instrument before we have them assess our children so that we're getting the very, very best data information so that we know how to move forward and what kinds of interventions we should do. We don't want to give them the wrong interventions because we have an incorrect score. Did you have trouble getting a CVI range for Rosalie? And then kind of walk us through the process of how you were able to engage with someone who had their endorsement.
Yes. Well, did we have trouble? Yes and no. So basically, you know, we got the referral for the vision services to be added on to like her early intervention stuff we were doing. In North Carolina, it's like two separate agencies. There's like the early intervention, and then there's one specifically just for vision and hearing. And I know in some states, it's all just through one organization that does their early intervention. But so I knew from my experience with getting referred to early intervention that, you know, they had legally, they had like 90 days to contact me once the referral was in. And so I didn't know how long the vision agency had legally to contact me, but I knew being like a state organization or a government agency, like that there was some time frame within which, you know, I could just be sitting around waiting. Right. So I just kind of took it upon myself to go online and find that agency, and I called them up and got a hold to one of their intake coordinators and told them, you know, I've been referred to you guys, so I'm waiting to hear from you. But in the meantime, I have all these questions. And so I spoke with one of their intake coordinators. She was super helpful, super knowledgeable just about like the local vision impairment community. But at that point, I had already gone on the Perkins School for the Blind website. I had found their database of all these people that were endorsed to be qualified and perform the CVI range assessment. And so at the time, I knew there were two people in North Carolina
And I think we have five now.
I think it's
right?
six. I was just looking last week, and I think there's six now. So
you know,
amazing.
It's just a point of pride, I think, for North Carolina, because we fall behind in so many things.
Yes,
and our education system, you know, it's not ranking in the top.
Not the best.
It's good to see that the ranks of CVI range endorsed people are continuing to grow in our state.
Definitely. Yes. That makes me so excited. But yeah, so even when we got the diagnosis, that was like 10 months ago now. Wow. There were only two in the state. And so I asked the intake coordinator about it because I think I knew one was like a private consultant, and then I wasn't sure if the other one worked for the state agency or whatever. And she confirmed that, you know, one of them did work for this state agency that does all this stuff with the early intervention vision services. But, you know, she informed me that she's like over 3 hours away in a different part of the state, and she's not going to be assigned to you. She flat out told me, she's like, I already pulled up your file. I can see who you've been assigned to. And, you know, that's just too far away. And I asked if they would at least, you know, send her to do the CVI range assessment. And at that point, the answer was just flat out like, no, they were not going to be able to do that. So as soon as I knew that the person that we were going to be assigned to through the state agency did not have that endorsement, and, you know, I just didn't really know what kinds of CVI experience she had, but I did know she for sure could not administer the assessment, which would really tell me where Rosalie was at and what I needed to be doing. My husband and I agreed, like, we're just going to call up this private consultant, and, you know, we paid out of pocket to do it. It was worth it, obviously, but it's a little frustrating that it's like, we qualify for these free state services, and then they have people that are endorsed, but then they can't even do that for us, you know, for free. We had to go out of our way to, like, hire someone and pay for it. You know, if you're willing to pay and you can find someone in your area or travel to them, yeah, then it's not that hard, quote unquote, to find someone. You know, that's just what we had to do at the time. And thankfully, she's like 10 minutes down the road from our house, which was such an amazing thing when I discovered, like, she had just opened this new clinic and it's in our town. And, you know, it was just, it was meant to be, you know, and we had a great experience working with her. And we did our first two assessments with her, with the private consultant. Working on getting our third one now, actually through the state agency.
Oh, great.
So
how does that change?
Well, basically, when the TBI we were assigned to came out, she did her functional vision assessment, which we know is not really appropriate for a child with CVI, but like legally she's required to do it or whatever. And so she performed that and came back with her recommendation of, you know, how often she should come and work with Rosalie. Like she offered us once a month or maybe two times a month. That was like the most that she ever sees any of her other kids. Which was really frustrating to me because with CVI, we know that our kids can improve so much. And I already had seen Rosalie improving so much. I was like, that's really not.
And at her age.
That's not enough. She's so young. Yeah. And the private consultant that did her range assessment had told us I would recommend really pushing for weekly services since she does have CVI and we can expect a lot of change from her. I wasn't like really on board with that recommendation. And, you know, I spoke with my services coordinator for early intervention and told her, you know, I'm not really willing to just like say yes to this because I'd like to try and see if we can work it out and be a little bit of a better situation for Rosalie. And so, you know, she sat down with the TBI and myself before we even started services. And we kind of hashed out all this stuff about why she was recommending this, what the game plan was. And I kind of really like quizzed her on what her experience was with CVI, what her credentials were. I kind of put her in the hot seat a little bit. Like I wasn't trying to be aggressive about it, but I really just needed to know, like, are you really qualified to be working with my child? Because this is really important. You know, we just in the beginning settled on doing the two times a month and we would see how it goes. And fast forward maybe a few months and I was just kind of feeling like it was a waste of our time, to be honest. And I called up my services coordinator again and talked to her and said, you know, can we see if we can maybe get a different TBI that just has more CVI experience? Like they don't even necessarily have to be endorsed, but just, you know, have more CVI experience with different kids. You know, if not, like, I think we should figure out another game plan. And because I just really didn't feel like it was benefiting Rosalie. She was absolutely benefiting from what I was doing at home. But, you know, I really needed someone who knew more about it than I do, that's more of an expert and could really take things to the next level for us. And We just weren't getting that. And so at that point, I saw a big shift in what the state agency was telling us and what they suddenly could offer us. Because they came back and they were like, okay, well, we can't give you a different TBI. And part of that is there's just not enough to go around. And they have, they're spread so thin with their caseload already. And there's only so many people in our part of the state. They were like, but we can get this Perkins Roman in Dorsey, who is like 3.5 hours away, to come and do her assessments for you. And, you know, we can also get her to come out occasionally and come with your TBI and kind of shadow and mentor her a little bit. And, you know, this is stuff that I had asked for in the very beginning when I had that sit down with the services coordinator and the TBI and we were initially talking about what we were going to do. I asked for like everything under the sun just to see what we could do to make this work. And everything I had asked for at that point was like, no, we can't do that. No, we can't do that. No, sorry, we just can't do that. And then all of a sudden they came back and they're like, so we can do this for you now.
What do you think helped them to find a different perspective?
I don't know, honestly. I think, I really do think that the people we're working with, her TBI that we've been assigned to, she's a great therapist. I can tell she's very passionate about helping kids. And I do think that people have the best intentions and they really do want to help all these kids that have vision impairments. And so, I don't know, I hope maybe they're just kind of realizing that there's more and more of these kids out there and we really need to get on board and give people appropriate services. At that point too, when they all of a sudden said, we could send this person out to do the CVI range assessments for you, they also told me that they're working on getting more and more of their TBIs endorsed and that they were ultimately trying to get all of them in the state agency endorsed, but they're gonna do 2 at a time and to send them through the training. So, I mean, that's huge if they're really going to do that and follow through with that, because I really think it needs to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfair for TBIs to not be given the support they need to pursue more education that they actually need. I mean, their caseload reflects that need. Well, I appreciate hearing your advocacy journey and kind of the step-by-step of you know, how you ask questions and advocate for your child to get what she needs, because it can feel very daunting. And I know there are times when we don't know what the next step is.
Yeah.
We don't know what to ask for.
That's true.
We don't know where to push or who to go to. What would you tell a parent who has not yet sought out a CVI range for his or her child and maybe even doesn't know where to start to find a qualified person to conduct that?
Well, I would absolutely recommend that you do whatever you can to get a CVI range assessment performed by someone who is endorsed and qualified to do that, because it's really the only way to know where your child truly falls on the range, what phase they're in, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and what you can be working on in the day-to-day. I mean, the way that I did it really was I went on the Perkins School for the Blind website, and they have an awesome database on there where you can search your state and see how many people, who they are, how to contact them. Usually it says, too, if they are a private consultant or if they work for maybe your school's Department of Education or something like that, but you can try and reach out to them. And, you know, if there's not people in your state, then if it was me, I would start looking outside the box and say, okay, well, what states are near us and where am I willing to drive, and check their database and see, you know, where you might need to go to get that. But so, I mean, even if you can't work with an endorsed professional, at least getting the range assessment so that you can take that home and know what to be working on in the meantime until you can get another assessment and get reassessed later. I just think that's really, really beneficial.
Do you mind sharing, has Rosalie seen progress on the CVI range? What does that look like?
She has seen so much progress. My goodness. The first time we got her assessed, it was technically an approximate score because she was not quite 9 months old. So the TBI was very clear that, you know, you can't officially say this is really their score till they're 9 months. But she was like 8.5 months or something. And we just wanted to get it done as soon as possible because I just really wanted to be working on stuff. So I feel that her first range score was very accurate to where she was at. And so at the time, she was kind of like bridging that gap of entering phase two. You know, one of her scores was like a 2.75 then, but then her rating one for overall how she was functioning was a 4. So she was like just crossing into phase two. The last assessment that we got, she was solidly in phase two it was amazing. Like, you, I mean, the progress that she's made is above and beyond what is typical for a child with CVI, because about 4 months after her first assessment, so this was back in October, she was 12 months old. Both of her ratings had improved by 2 points. So she had all of a sudden a 4.75 for how she was functioning for rating two within all the characteristics of CVI, but then her overall functioning score was a 6. Mm-hmm. So that's like, that's huge. That's a huge jump. And that really put her solidly in phase two. They actually came to try and do it this week, and she has a cold. And it was, she was so miserable that we could basically do the interview and not really do much else. She was just not.
You've got to pick up on those cues.
Yeah. So we're going to have to finish it in a few weeks and have them come back and get her score. And she's definitely made a lot of improvement.
So with a score that's in phase two, what are some examples of adaptations that are appropriate for her at this point and activities that you do with her to help drive that ventral stream?
Yeah, so phase two, you know, is all about integrating vision with function. You know, when we first started off, I was just trying to get her to look at stuff, and it didn't really matter what it was, as long as it was bright and shiny and moving and whatever. But it became really important in phase two to be thinking about, like, everyday objects that she uses. So, for example, when we feed her in the high chair, we really lucked out when we got her this high chair. It just worked out that it has, like, a top tray you can take off, and then the bottom tray is black.
Oh, wow.
And so it was perfect for a kid.
That's interesting.
CVI.
You see a lot of cream.
Yes. Yeah. So the top one is cream, but then you take it off and it's black. And we got this before we knew about her CVI, right? So kind of amazing. So we have like a black tray, and then, you know, her spoons that we use are usually solid colored or maybe like white with a bright color, but very simple, not like complex, easy to see. So just using stuff like that in her everyday, like her bibs are like bright solid colors, and I'll show her bib before I put it on and say, this is your yellow bib, or whatever color it might be that day. And like, you know, just anything that we're doing. So like for bath time, I intentionally use like a bright yellow towel and a bright yellow washcloth. And we found bath toys that light up, you know, that are really fun for her to look at. We just describe them to her and let her play with them. And, you know, she just loves stuff like that. So whatever she's looking at, whatever she's playing with, we just try and make sure that whatever she's using in her day-to-day is appropriate for her and not too complex or something that she can access visually.
Yeah. It's got to be a lifestyle.
Yes, absolutely.
The CVI appropriate strategies have to be a lifestyle. They're not a therapy, and it's integrated into all of the things that are important to her.
Right. Yes.
At this age and her activities and what she's interested in. Mm-hmm. So that's probably why you named your blog Everyday CVI.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Because we have to do stuff every day, all day, every day.
And is your goal there to document real life strategies and kind of what you're doing and what you found to work?
Yeah. So basically on the blog, I've taken lots of pictures. You know, I'm just constantly documenting things that we're doing for her. And I don't really know why I started doing that, but I just have always been taking pictures. I think it helps me mentally to be able to look back and see, you know, things we've done or how much progress she's made. So at some point, I just realized that, you know, when we got the diagnosis, what I would have really loved is one place to just go and get ideas. And parent groups on Facebook can be so good for that. But like you were saying earlier, you don't always know what questions to ask or what you're looking for when you get a diagnosis. So, I mean, if you're like looking in the parent groups on Facebook, like I don't necessarily know to look for feeding strategies or bath time or whatever. Like when you're brand new to it, you just don't even know where to start or what to do. And so I would see parents sharing helpful things like, oh, my kid loves this light up toy and stuff like that. And, you know, that always gives me good ideas. But there was nowhere I could really go and just say, okay, I need ideas for phase one toys, or, you know, what do I do in phase two for bath time, or, you know, just different things like that. So I figured if I would have found that really helpful, then I hope that by documenting it and putting it out there, maybe it'll help other people mm-hmm. so that when they're new to the diagnosis, they can go and just get some inspiration. Because obviously it's going to be different for every child with CBI, but at least it's kind of like a starting point where you can search by categories. If you're looking for feeding or playing or on the go, you know, you can just click on the tabs on the blog and find different things that I've done.
That's great. Yeah, we definitely need a clearinghouse or a portal of CBI resources and ideas that's, I don't know, kind of crowdsourced from lots of different points of view and what different things have worked for a variety of kids so that mm-hmm. it is easier to find, you know, the practical steps to take with our kids.
Yeah, because you can find a lot of stuff online that is kind of repetitive, I would say, with CBI. It's like everybody knows at this point in phase one that you want to use like Mylar balloons and that shiny stuff. And that's great. Those are good tips, but you need to be able to think more outside the box and say, well, but what do I do beyond that? What do we do next? Mm-hmm. So it is really helpful just to, you know, it helps me learning from other parents, seeing, you know, toys they recommend and stuff like that. Yeah, that's kind of why I started the blog, just to put it out there. So hopefully it'll help someone somewhere.
So people can find it at everydaycbi.com.
That's right.
Okay. What about books? Are you adapting books at all? Or I mean, you say you're a bookworm, right, yourself.
Yes,
so it's probably important to have a rich library of things that Rosalie can access. So what are some of her favorites, and have you had to adapt any of them?
So at this point in time, you know, I haven't done much adapting with books just because I've been so busy with three young kids and just wrapping our heads around this diagnosis that I was kind of looking around saying, okay, I don't have time to do this. So what books would work for us right now? And I actually wrote a blog post about some beginning books that we've used with Rosalie that I like just because she does see like simple black and white easily. And that's not true of every kid with CBI, but for her, that works with like pops of color. So I found books like that. You know, she really loves this, I don't even remember what it's called, So Big. It's like a Sesame Street Beginnings book with Elmo. And it just has Elmo on every page. And he's just doing different things. And, you know, she recognizes Elmo because we have a stuffed Elmo doll. And she has a little red Elmo rattle. And it's easy for her to see and process. So she loves that book right now. She can't point with her finger yet, but just even tapping and asking her, like, where is Elmo's nose, and trying to get her to tap on things like that. You just have to use what motivates your kid. Mm-hmm. And so for her, she loves Elmo and Cookie Monster and Big Bird right now. So trying to play to those interests have been really helpful.
What does Rosalie enjoy other than her Sesame Street friends?
She loves music. She's a really, really musical kid. And I would say all my kids have been interested in music, but from a young age, but in different ways. Like my oldest has always been really into instruments. And then my second child, he just loves to dance. Like you put on music and he's moving. And then Rosalie, from a young age, you know, if you would put on music or sing to her, she would kind of like coo along and sing with you. It was just the cutest thing. I have videos of her like singing with me as a baby. So music has just always been a really big interest of hers. It's really motivating. So from pretty early on, you know, I would get a lot of musical toys. So for some kids with CBI, that can be a little too complicated to be looking and listening to the music at the same time. But for her, that really would pique her interest. If she heard the music, then she'd look and she wanted to see what it was. So she loves musical toys. That's a big, big favorite of hers.
And that sense, I'm sure, is heightened and quite acute.
Oh yeah, I definitely think she's got good hearing. Like before we knew about her CBI, she startles so easily. If she's like in the bassinet or something, like back when she slept in our room when she was really little, and if you walk by, it was kind of like you had to be really careful about waking her up. And in hindsight, I really think that's linked to the fact that, of course, she has a vision impairment, so her hearing is really strong.
Grace, as a baby, would cry every time an airplane flew over the house or the landscaping crew came to a neighbor's house.
Oh, my goodness.
But once we started to be able to name what it was for her, and she had a mm-hmm. name to go with it, and that we, as she got older and could understand that these things were not an immediate threat, mm-hmm. she moved on from that. And she also came to be able to name the difference between the sound of a lawnmower and a weed whacker and a... leaf blower.
That's so impressive for a little kid to differentiate.
Such important knowledge, but
you're right.
Yeah, it speaks to that.
It's a skill, though.
Yeah, you can apply it to other things.
Right, right.
If I've done my math correctly, you're coming up on the year anniversary of your CBI diagnosis?
Yeah, in May. So in just a couple more months.
So what does that milestone mean to you and your family?
Oh, I don't know. When I think about it, it's kind of like a heavy thing to think about, you know, because when I think about the day we got the diagnosis, that was a really hard day. Once I went home and started researching and really grasping just the magnitude of what this meant for our lives and for her. And up to that point, you know, hydrocephalus is a medical condition, but in and of itself, it's not a disability. It can cause any number of, you know, physical or cognitive disabilities, but in and of itself, it's a medical condition. And so that was the first time that I really was aware and understood that, okay, well, now we're not just like special medical needs parents. We're parents of a child with a disability. And that just, I don't know, that was just another level of trying to wrap my head around that. And so in that sense, like, I think that's kind of hard when you reflect on that. But at the same time, I look back and I think about how far we've come in 1 year. You know, her progress has just been unreal. And so the fact that we got that diagnosis, it is such a gift. I consider it a huge blessing because the more involved I become in the CBI community, I realize how uncommon our story is. And there are just too many kids that are not being diagnosed or they're getting misdiagnosed. And so I'm just super grateful that we got a diagnosis. When we did, it was accurate, you know, and we were able to start implementing things right away. Because without the diagnosis, I don't even know where we'd be right now, because vision really impacts everything. Mm-hmm. So knowing about it allows us to do something about it. And that's, you know, that gives me a lot of hope and a lot of peace.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing how the moment you realize you're the parent of a child with disability, it stretches your identity into all of these new avenues and ways that you never could have imagined you were even going to have to go.
Well, and this, like, it sounds so silly, but, you know, we knew about her hydrocephalus for months, right? Because it was a prenatal diagnosis. But even after she was born, I didn't even really understand yet that I was a special needs parent. That sounds so ridiculous looking back, but I just didn't really get it because I knew, okay, well, it's a medical condition. She's going to have surgery. And, you know, I know we're going to need to do physical therapy, obviously, when she's young, because she's going to be delayed being born with a larger, heavier head. But it didn't really hit me until when we were in the hospital with her shunt infection. A friend emailed me, it was some article about, like, you know, kind of the beautiful paradox of special needs parenting. And I thought, oh, that's nice. She sent that to me. But, like, why is she sending this to me? Which is so ridiculous. I was like, oh, does she think I'm a special needs parent? And I thought about it and it dawned on me. And I was like, oh, I am a special needs parent, because even if everything were to go perfectly with Rosalie's shunt, you know, forever, she had never needed other surgeries, she will forever have, you know, a medical condition that requires a piece of hardware for her to live and function, and she needs follow-up appointments with all these specialists. And so, I mean, of course that's being a special needs parent, because that's not typical. Like, that's not a normal need to have 20 MRIs before you're like 1.5 years old and all of that stuff. So that's when I finally realized and really embraced the idea that, oh, okay, I'm a special needs parent now. And so I started embracing that identity. And so it does, it really stretches your identity and just how you kind of think about yourself and your family and how you perceive the world and the world perceives you. It's just, it's fascinating.
Probably you weren't ready to embrace that identity yet.
Yeah.
I think it's your way of protecting yourself. Like, I remember the day Grace got her diagnosis for visual impairment, and I went back to work and I walked into the cafeteria and I sat down with my colleagues and I looked at my boss and I was like, Grace has a visual impairment. And how do you think she received that? I don't even remember. I think I was just kind of shell-shocked. It hadn't soaked in.
Yeah.
I went back to work. Like, looking back, I think I would have gone to take some time.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But to process in the moment, you're just, it's kind of like, oh, okay. So yeah, that's what we're doing now. And yeah, it doesn't really hit you yet. So I can relate to that. Definitely.
Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you'd like to share?
Well, I guess, I mentioned that Rosalie has made such drastic progress, and obviously part of that is just knowing about her diagnosis and implementing everyday strategies and being really involved in all that. But, I think another thing worth mentioning that I believe has really contributed to her rapid progress is the fact that we participated in a research study at Duke involving stem cell infusions. I see parents ask about that in some of the Facebook groups mm-hmm. online about what that is. So maybe I should share a little bit.
I would love to hear about that. How did she qualify for that? Was because of her hydrocephalus diagnosis?
Those
were the only population that they were accepting into the study?
It was not the only population, but I learned about it when I was pregnant with her, and I was, finding hydrocephalus parents and communities online, and people started mentioning it to me, and, I was thrilled because it's at Duke, and that is our hospital where mm-hmm. Rosalie goes for all of her specialists, where she was going to be born. Parents, they travel all over the country for this, like hydrocephalus parents do, to get these infusions for their kids. But it's really, it's part of a research study looking at the potential of stem cells to repair neurological damage.
Okay.
And so they do it with different populations. And I know there's like a few diagnoses that kind of get you like preference with it. And hydrocephalus was one of those, because one of the biggest populations that they've seen positive outcomes with the stem cell infusions are babies born with hydrocephalus. I contacted Duke about this. We banked her cord blood at Duke, and that way we had the stem cells from her blood mm-hmm. to do
and
these
it
infusions.
Has to be so her own stem
yeah,
cells
so
for
this research study, they're autologous cells, meaning it's your stem cells from your body. I think they do have some other research studies going on at Duke where they're using like sibling stem cells. They're doing a lot of different research studies with this at Duke. But yes, for the one that we participated in, it was her own cells. And so basically, they try and do the stem cell infusions as early as possible. But like in Rosalie's case, we had so many medical situations going on in those early months that we could not get in there and get the ball rolling right away because they needed to see, follow-up imaging after her surgeries, make sure everything was good and stable with her shunt before doing all of this. We got her first stem cell infusion when she was 5 months old, which was before we knew about her CVI diagnosis. And then they do the dose of how many stem cells they use based on like your child's weight. You'll get as many stem cell infusions, as many cells that you have. Mm-hmm. They'll use
them. It's just based on your resources.
Right. So it's based on your resources, how good the collection was. And then every time they freeze it and thaw it, they wash them and lose some and all of that. So, so Rosalie was able to get 2 stem cell infusions. And some kids only get one, and the most usually is about 3. So we were really hoping to get a third one, but the second one used up all of her cells. But yeah, so the first one was when she was 5 months old. And so that was really interesting because we didn't know about her CVI at the time, but we started seeing changes in her right away, just in the way that she interacted. I distinctly remember before the stem cell infusion, she had transferred a toy from one hand to the other literally one time in her life. And it had been a couple weeks before the infusion. And I was sitting next to her, like watching her figure it out. And she was like thinking so hard and, like really, really working. How do I do this? And she finally did it after 15 minutes of trying to transfer this toy to her other hand. And, I was so proud of her. But literally within a day of her stem cell infusion, she just casually started transferring toys back and forth, right to left, like immediately. And we were like, what? This is crazy. And then...
did anyone outside of your family notice?
Well, that's a good question because I feel like we were so isolated in those early months that other people weren't seeing her regularly because we were also just terrified of you know, she was born in the fall and it was flu season, mm-hmm. and we were really avoiding anything that could send us to the hospital or be misconstrued with signs of like a shunt infection, sure. or a malfunction. So that's a good question. But I don't think there was anybody really that would have known. But it was so obvious to my husband and me right away. But she just really became so much more interactive. Like before, we would tickle her and she would just kind of look at us. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And then we got the stem cell infusion and we would tickle her and she would laugh and she would interact with us like, oh, this is fun. This is what you're doing. And the other big change we saw right away was she was motivated to move like for the first time ever, because, you know, she was delayed with her gross motor skill. She wasn't rolling yet, but all of a sudden she started trying to roll. And so in hindsight, it's really clear to us that like all the changes we saw in her were directly linked to her vision and how she was functioning with that. Because of course, if you can't really see what's around you, like you're not motivated to move, right. and it's harder to interact and do all of these things. So I feel very confident in saying that that absolutely helped give her a big boost with her vision, because knowing what I know about CVI now and the different phases, I feel like she was solidly in phase one prior to her first stem cell infusion, but it was 2 months after her first infusion, we got the diagnosis, and then, you know, she was about 8.5 months old when we got her first assessment. So that's the first time we have anything documented
right.
about where she was at. But then she got her second and final stem cell infusion, maybe 10 days or so after her first CVI range assessment. And in those first 4 months from assessment one to assessment two, like I said, she basically progressed at the rate you would think it would take her 2 years to progress on the CVI range. So I feel like that absolutely helped a mm-hmm. lot.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Where are the research studies that has Duke published this yet? Or there, is there something that
so this
research
is
you can read about?
It's an ongoing research study, which is why some people, when they ask their doctors about it, like I've heard of other hydrocephalus parents like asking the neurosurgeon or the neurologist, like, oh, should I do this? I've heard of this thing. And a lot of doctors just kind of say, oh, it's experimental research. Like, there's not much evidence to show that it helps. But that's because they're like, they're still researching it and it's still ongoing. And so they haven't published everything. Mm-hmm. But if you can get connected with a parent who's done it, like, hands down, anecdotally, I've never encountered a parent that's done it that did not say it absolutely helped my child.
Right.
Like, I've never encountered a parent that said, yeah, we just didn't really see any difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that, especially because it's her own cells, it can't possibly harm her.
Right.
It only has the potential to, you know, benefit her
yeah.
in some way. And you just, I mean, you don't know how it's going to benefit them. But I mean, the theory behind it is stem cells, they want to go into the body and repair damaged cells. And so it makes sense when you think about a child with, you know, some type of brain injury, if there's a lot of damage in one part of your body, that's where the cells are going to go.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to want to target that. You know, especially with Rosalie, basically her whole brain was under a lot of pressure as her brain was forming. She was growing in utero. But especially the part of her brain that does process vision, it was like, for lack of a better medical term, basically her brain was squished by all of this cerebral spinal fluid
right.
in there. And that part of her brain was like especially squished,
mm-hmm.
Which was very obvious, you know, on her MRI at birth. It makes sense, you know, that the stem cells would go in some way help improve whatever functioning within her brain. And if vision was really impacted, then it makes sense that we would see progress in that mm-hmm. department. Especially neuroplasticity, we know, is so great from birth to age 3. If you can repair some of that damage at a young age, then obviously that can only help you.
Well, your story is one of a lot of hope.
Yes.
So
thankfully. I'm so thankful.
Yeah. So thanks for sharing it.
Thank you for inviting me to share with you. It's
yeah.
been a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's a different experience, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. I guess Rosalie gets her mighty nature honest. I'm in awe of all of you who, like Stephanie, manage health scares, surgeries, IEP or IFSP meetings, multiple children, multiple diagnoses, and on top of that, advocacy efforts. All with a smile and a twinkle in your eye. It's friends like Stephanie and all of you who give me strength and hope.
Take a look at Stephanie's blog, everydaycvi.com. You'll find a nice variety of posts categorized by topics like around the home, holidays, bath time, sleep tracking, feeding, and more. And please, if I've earned your time and you enjoy hearing CVI stories like this one, subscribe and leave a comment or rating. Kaleidoscope CVI Podcast is available on all the major listening platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. And as Stephanie and I say down here in North Carolina, thanks, y'all.